I want you to imagine trying to build a massive industrial city, like a 50-megawatt facility.
Right, which is huge.
Yeah, it's massive. But I want you to picture building it in, one of the most remote, semi-arid regions on Earth, a place where infrastructure is scarce and the environment is just completely unforgiving.
Okay, so essentially starting from zero.
Exactly, from zero. And here is the real kicker. You are going to build this sprawling industrial complex without ever, and I mean ever, connecting it to a national power grid.
I mean, on paper, that sounds like a total logistical nightmare. Or like a thought experiment that just falls apart the second you look at the engineering constraints.
Right, it sounds impossible. But today, our mission for this deep dive is to explore exactly that. We are looking at a highly detailed master plan for an eco-industrial park, or EIP, planned for the Karamoja region of northeastern Uganda.
Yeah, and this isn't just about throwing down some solar panels. We are breaking down an entirely self-sustaining industrial ecosystem.
A completely gridless green island.
Exactly. We are looking at a system where, the waste heat coming off a high-tech artificial intelligence data center is mathematically calibrated to cure luxury marble slabs.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand how a massive industrial park survives in total isolation, you first have to grasp the concept of behind-the-meter generation, or BTM.
Right, the BTM strategy is the whole foundation.
Yeah, and you also need to look at the four very specific anchor tenants moving into this park to make the economics actually work. To me, BTM generation feels a bit like cutting the cord on your cable company, but scaled up for an entire industrial city.
That is a great way to look at it.
You are bypassing the utility provider completely, generating your power on site and using it right there.
And the financial architecture of that decision is staggering when you look at a remote place like Karamoja. I mean, by operating as a private microgrid, this park entirely avoids the need to build a 132 kilovolt substation.
Which is not cheap.
No, not at all. For those unfamiliar, a substation of that size involves massive transformers, complex switchgear, and, miles of high voltage transmission lines.
Just to connect to the national grid.
Right. So by skipping that entirely, the park erases anywhere from $15 million to $65 million in capital expenditure right out of the gate.
Wait, they essentially delete a $65 million line item from the budget just by choosing to be an island?
Exactly. And beyond the money, there's the timeline constraint.
Oh, right, the bureaucracy.
Yeah. In remote regions, waiting for a national utility to survey, approve, and actually construct that kind of heavy infrastructure. I mean, that can stall a project for 3 to 5 years.
Wow, that's a massive delay.
But by keeping everything behind the meter, this park can spin up and be operational the moment the power plant and the factories are finished. It brings the timeline down to closer to 18 to 24 months.
Plus, you dodge the transmission and distribution charges, right? Those can easily eat up, what, 30 to 40% of a
Right.
standard industrial electricity bill.
Yeah, easily. But there is a catch. The foundational rule of an isolated microgrid is that generation has to match consumption perfectly.
Right, because there's no grid to dump the excess power into.
Exactly. If you generate 50 megawatts internally, you need a highly predictable set of engines, so to speak, to consume that power cleanly within the fences. Which brings us to the four primary tenets.
Okay, let's run through them.
First is industrial marble processing. This is the heavy lifter, drawing between 15 and 20 megawatts. The Karamoja region sits on these vast deposits of raw marble.
And processing it takes a lot of juice.
It does. It requires massive diamond wire saws to cut the raw blocks, followed by, heavy polishing machinery.
Which makes sense for the location, but the second tenant is what really surprised me. They are dropping a Tier 3 data center into the middle of this semi-arid plateau.
Yeah, drawing another 10 to 15 megawatts.
And for you listening, a Tier 3 facility means it has multiple paths for power and cooling. It allows for concurrent maintainability, so basically it guarantees near perfect uptime.
Right, and they are placing this there to provide regional digital sovereignty and AI readiness for East Africa, which is a massive leap for the local tech infrastructure.
Then you have the third tenant, which connects the park to the local agricultural economy.
The industrial cold storage facility.
Yeah, requiring about 10 megawatts. It's the backbone for the region's meat and dairy export chain, providing the deep freezing capacity to prep beef and goat for international markets.
And then the fourth tenant is the really vital piece of the microgrid puzzle. It's a green hydrogen pilot plant drawing about 5 to 10 megawatts.
I really want to dig into that hydrogen plant, actually, because its primary job isn't just making fuel, is it? It acts as a load-shedding buffer.
That's right.
Let's say the sun comes out from behind a cloud and solar generation spikes, but the marble factory happens to be on a shift change and isn't drawing power.
Which is a huge problem on an islanded grid.
Exactly. On a normal grid, that excess power has nowhere to go and could trip the whole system. But electrolyzers in a hydrogen plant can instantly ramp up production to soak up that exact excess spike.
They basically act as a massive shock absorber for the microgrid. They turn unpredictable solar surges into stored hydrogen gas.
It's so smart. But combining these specific tenets creates a pretty severe physical conflict.
Yeah, a massive one. I mean, marble processing involves cutting and grinding raw stone. That naturally produces huge clouds of fine particulate dust.
And meanwhile, data centers are essentially pristine clean rooms.
Exactly. Those server racks need highly filtered air so the microprocessors don't overheat or short out. So placing a stone quarry next to a server farm seems, well, fundamentally flawed.
Which brings us to the zoning strategy. And this is just a brilliant piece of spatial engineering. They use what they call the Karamoja diamond layout.
Right. They analyzed the southeasterly prevailing winds across the plateau.
Yeah. And they situated the data center on the extreme upwind edge of the diamond. So the intake vents only pull in fresh, undisturbed air.
And the marble processing facility is relegated to the complete opposite downwind side of the park.
And to make absolutely sure there's no cross-contamination, they planted a green buffer between them. It's this dense, engineered forest of drought-resistant neem and acacia trees.
It's really clever. The foliage is specifically layered to act as a physical net. It catches and filters any stray stone dust before it can blow backward across the campus.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Now that we know who lives in this park, we need to understand how they interact.
Because the real genius here isn't the solar power itself. It's the architecture of the park. They use a concept called a circular thermal island.
Right. In a standard industrial setup, factories operate in complete silos. They buy power, do their work, and just vent their waste out the chimney.
But here, the system is designed around the principle that one facility's discarded energy is another facility's primary fuel.
Remember that $4 million electrical substation they didn't build? They replaced it with a 2-kilometer thermal backbone.
And this isn't just a basic pipe. It is a heavily insulated, high-capacity circulatory system. It carries various grades of heat throughout the entire park.
The symbiotic loops are where this design just shines. Let's look at the low-grade loop first.
Okay.
Those servers in the data center are doing heavy computational work. As a byproduct, they generate an enormous amount of heat.
Right. And normally, a data center spends a massive chunk of its operating budget just running industrial air conditioners.
Literally just to blast that 35 to 45 degrees Celsius air up into the atmosphere. Cooling is traditionally a data center's biggest bottleneck.
But what's fascinating here is that rather than treating that heat as a liability to be vented, the thermal backbone captures it. It routes it directly into the marble curing rooms.
Which is brilliant, because when you process marble for luxury markets, you have to apply specific epoxy resins. It stabilizes the stone and fills any microfissures.
Yeah, and for those chemical resins to cure perfectly, meaning they harden without turning cloudy or brittle, the ambient temperature has to stay completely stable.
Right, between 21 and 27 degrees Celsius and for several days.
So the data center's exhaust is doing the exact work of an industrial space heater.
That single loop intercepts 2 to 4 megawatts of electrical demand. Power that the marble facility would have otherwise pulled from the solar array just to run electric heaters.
You're getting two entirely different industrial processes powered by the exact same electron.
It's incredible, and the cascading efficiencies continue into the cold chain loop.
Right. The industrial refrigeration compressors that deep freeze the meat also reject a significant amount of heat, usually around 50 to 70 degrees Celsius.
And the thermal backbone harvests that rejected heat too. It routes it to the green hydrogen plant to preheat the water before it enters the electrolyzer.
The physics of that are fascinating. When you feed an electrolyzer warm water instead of cold water, you literally alter the thermodynamics of the process.
Because it takes less electrical energy to break the molecular bonds of water when the water is already carrying thermal energy, right?
Exactly. By simply preheating the intake, they boost the hydrogen production efficiency by 10 to 15%.
It's basically the industrial equivalent of filling your kettle with hot tap water before you turn it on. You use less energy to reach the boiling point.
And then the hydrogen electrolyzer itself generates heat during operation. It runs at about 60 to 80 degrees Celsius.
Which creates the medium grade loop.
Right. They channel this higher grade heat into a multi-effect distillation unit, or MED. because in regions like Karamoja, the groundwater can be highly saline or packed with heavy minerals.
For you listening, MED is essentially a series of low-pressure boiling chambers. You use that waste heat from the electrolyzer to flash the dirty groundwater into steam.
The heavy minerals and salts are left behind.
Yeah, and the steam is condensed back into completely pure water. They use this distilled water for the liquid cooling systems inside the data center.
And it also provides a pristine drinking water source for the local community.
Which is huge. And that brings us to the water loop itself, which is a critical constraint on a semi-arid plateau.
Yeah, water is everything there. Cutting raw marble with diamond wire saws requires an immense volume of water just for lubrication and cooling the blades.
However, the resulting wastewater isn't chemically toxic. It's simply heavily loaded with silty stone dust.
So they run it through physical clarifiers, filter out the suspended stone dust, and send 95% of that water directly into the park's agricultural zones.
That recycling drops their overall groundwater draw by 60%.
What's fascinating here is that this entirely shifts capital expenditure from distribution to efficiency.
Yeah. In a legacy grid, you dump capital into miles of copper wire and transformers.
Just to move power from point A to point B. But in this circular model, electricity is strictly used for mechanical or computational work like spinning a saw or running a server.
And the waste heat is captured and put to work creating actual value, like curing stone or purifying drinking water.
But to drive all of these heavy industrial loops, you need a colossal continuous energy source.
You do. And when you are building off-grid, your local geography dictates your technology.
Which leads us to a really fascinating comparison from the sources. Have you looked at the CGN Wumatang project in Tibet?
I have, yeah. As of 2026, Wumatang is recognized as the world's highest altitude concentrated solar power plant. It's up at like 4,550 meters in the Himalayas.
It is a 450 megawatt hybrid facility designed to provide stable baseload power. And they don't just rely on standard solar panels up there.
No, they use a technology called parabolic trough collectors.
Right. These are massive U-shaped mirrors, some spanning 8.6 meters across.
They slowly track the sun across the sky and focus concentrated sunlight onto a central receiver tube. And that tube is filled with a specialized thermal oil or molten salt.
Wumatang actually operates 400 megawatts of standard photovoltaics alongside this, but it integrates these troughs to heat vast tanks of molten salt.
So during peak daylight, when the solar panels are making more electricity than the grid can absorb, they use a 20 megawatt electric heater to pump that excess energy directly into the salt tanks.
Because salt retains heat so effectively, they can hold that thermal energy for hours.
Yeah, and then long after the sun goes down, they use that stored heat to boil water, generate steam, and spin a traditional turbine for 6 straight hours.
It provides a perfectly flat, reliable power curve, even in freezing conditions. It is a phenomenal engineering achievement.
It really is. But importing that exact technological footprint to Uganda, that presents a fatal flaw.
A massive one.
Right, because Tibet has freezing temperatures, but it also has abundant water from glacial runoff to supply those massive steam turbines.
And Karamoja is a semi-arid plateau. Water is, quite literally, more valuable than gold there.
If you design a power system relying on thousands of massive mirrors that need constant washing to remain reflective, plus a scum cycle that needs immense volumes of water for cooling, you are engineering a direct conflict.
You'd be pitting the industrial park's survival against the local pastoralists, people who desperately need that exact same water for their cattle herds.
The engineers behind the Karamoja Master Plan identified that exact socio-ecological conflict, didn't they?
They did. They evaluated the parabolic trough model and completely rejected it for the Ugandan site. Building a water-intensive power plant in a region facing seasonal droughts would be a catastrophic social failure.
So to solve the nighttime power gap without steam, they pivoted to a totally different stack of technologies.
They opted for bifacial solar PV.
Oh, right. These are the solar panels that generate electricity from sunlight hitting the front, but they also capture the ambient light bouncing off the ground onto the back.
Exactly. Since Karamoja has highly reflective, dry, sandy soil, bifacial panels squeeze a significant amount of extra yield out of the exact same footprint.
But to store that energy without molten salt, they install a massive 200 megawatt hour battery energy storage system, or BES.
Which is just a staggering amount of batteries.
To put that number into perspective for you listening, 200 megawatt hours is enough stored battery capacity to run tens of thousands of typical homes through the entire night.
All sitting in modular shipping containers right on the savannah.
And to smooth out the power curve as the batteries drain, they integrate 10 megawatts of wind turbines.
Yeah, capitalizing on the thermal winds that naturally accelerate across the plateau after sunset.
The water conservation efforts extend into the cooling systems for the tenants, too. They rely on air-cooled condensers, often referred to as dry cooling.
Right, and from a pure engineering standpoint, dry cooling is a painful compromise.
It really is. Instead of using water to pull heat away, you are basically using massive arrays of industrial fans to blow ambient air over heat exchangers.
And because air is much less dense than water, it's just a far less efficient medium for heat transfer.
Relying on dry cooling means the park takes a measurable 4% hit on its total electrical efficiency during the hottest hours of the day.
But that 4% efficiency sacrifice is the cost of saving 2,000 cubic meters of water every single day.
Which is totally worth it in that environment.
Absolutely. That design philosophy is crucial. The technology must actively integrate with and benefit the local Karamojong people rather than just extracting resources.
And what is really compelling is how prioritizing those local social dividends directly translates to massive financial advantages on the global market.
The clearest example of this is their approach to agrivoltaics, or solar plus grazing.
Right. The park allocates roughly 150 hectares for the solar array, but instead of fencing this massive area off and treating it as a sterile industrial zone, they elevate the solar panels 2.5 meters above the ground.
Which entirely changes the microclimate underneath the panels.
Yeah, the shadows cast by the solar array actually reduce the evaporation of moisture from the soil by 25 to 30%.
During the harsh, dry season, that shade allows the native grasses beneath the panels to remain green and nutrient-dense.
For like 3 to 5 weeks longer than the exposed rangeland outside the park's perimeter.
The park then integrates the local herdsmen directly into the footprint. They support a piece herd of 40 local cattle and 100 goats, which graze safely right beneath the infrastructure.
And we can actually measure the impact of this symbiotic grazing.
We can. Because these zebu cattle have shelter from the midday sun, meaning they spend way less caloric energy fighting heat stress. And they have access to the filtered water recovered from the marble plant, their milk yields explode.
They jump from 1.5 liters to 2.5 liters a day.
And here is where the anchor tenants come back into play. Because the industrial cold storage facility is sitting right next door, that excess milk doesn't just spoil in the heat.
It is pasteurized, chilled, and packaged right on site.
It transforms from a highly perishable local commodity into a value-added product that is transported and sold in larger nearby towns like Moroto and Cotito.
That single integration boosts the household incomes of the participating pastoralist families by 40%.
It creates a resilient local economy, which in turn secures the operational stability of the $45 million facility.
And the financials here are wild. Let's look at the core export, the marble. The traditional resource model in remote parts of Africa has been to blast the raw material out of the earth, load a massive unfinished block onto a truck, and ship it off to Europe or Asia.
Yeah, and the destination country does the high-value processing, so they capture almost all of the profit.
Right. But by utilizing the highly affordable behind-the-meter renewable energy, this park uses its own diamond saws and polishing lines to process the raw blocks into finished luxury slabs right there in Uganda.
That value addition creates a 38% profit margin and a highly attractive 2.8-year payback period for the investors.
But the financial upside doesn't stop at the polishing line. The entire legal and export strategy of this product is tied to its off-grid nature.
Because this marble is cut and polished using 100% renewable solar and wind power, it achieves NSI-NSAI 373 platinum status.
That is the highest possible sustainability certification for natural stone.
And here is where the data center does more than just regional AI processing. It actually runs a dedicated blockchain ledger.
Wait, a blockchain ledger for stone?
Yeah. It logs the telemetry of the solar array at the exact moment a specific slab of marble is cut.
Oh.
It provides mathematically unalterable proof of the zero carbon energy source for every single piece of stone. It officially brands it as green marble.
And that verifiable zero carbon footprint acts as a shield against global climate tariffs. The European Union enforces the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, or CBAM.
Right. Essentially, it is a strict tax levied on the embedded carbon emissions of imported industrial goods.
If you import stone cut using a dirty coal grid, you pay a massive penalty.
But because the Karamoja marble has cryptographically verified proof of its zero carbon origins, it is completely exempt from those EU taxes,
granting it an overwhelming competitive price advantage in Western luxury markets. There is one lingering paradox here, though.
What's that?
You have this pristine zero carbon product sitting on an isolated plateau. How do you actually move thousands of heavy, fragile slabs of stone out of a remote region and get them to an ocean port without destroying your carbon footprint with a fleet of diesel trucks?
Ah, right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the logistics network is the final piece of this circular puzzle, and it taps right back into the green hydrogen plant we discussed earlier.
So the hydrogen isn't just a load-shedding buffer for the microgrid.
No, it is literally the fuel for the export chain. The finished marble slabs are loaded onto specialized A-frame racks. Those racks are strapped to 30-ton flatbed trucks, fueled entirely by the park's own green hydrogen.
Wait, really? So the trucks are literally powered by the excess sunlight from the week before?
Precisely. These zero-emission trucks transport the stone 260 kilometers off the plateau to the logistics hubs in towns like Sirodi or Mbale.
And from there, the containers are transferred onto the standard gauge railway.
Yeah, rail transport is roughly 35% cheaper than road haulage. But more importantly for luxury stone, a train significantly reduces the physical vibrations that can cause microfractures in the marble.
And they take it a step further, right? They equip every single container with a G-force sensor.
Yes. If a slab takes a severe mechanical shock during transit, the logistics center is alerted instantly. The train carries the cargo the rest of the way to the port of Mombasa on the Indian Ocean, completing a zero-carbon journey from a remote African quarry to the global market.
So what does this all mean for you listening? We have explored a blueprint today that takes an isolated, water-scarce region and completely rewires the concept of industrial development.
We've seen how replacing wires with insulated thermal pipes creates a perfect closed-loop symbiosis.
A system where the waste heat of a server farm cures luxury stone, and where industrial refrigeration boosts the efficiency of hydrogen production.
They have managed to design a globally competitive, zero-carbon luxury export facility. And they did it while actively improving the local ecosystem and the daily lives of the Karamojong herdsmen.
The ingenuity required to build a 50-megawatt off-grid city forces us to reconsider the way we structure global industry.
It really does. And it leaves you with a much larger shifting paradigm to consider. We've just seen how extreme constraints, no grid, no water, remote location, force the creation of a perfectly efficient circular economy.
Yeah.
It raises an important question for you to mull over. As strict climate policies and carbon border taxes like CBAM become the permanent global reality, will we begin to see a massive exodus of heavy manufacturing?
It makes you wonder if the industrial capitals of the future will abandon the aging, gridlocked infrastructure of Europe and North America entirely.
Will the next generation of industry simply migrate to the remote, sun-drenched deserts of the equator, where green energy isn't just remarkably cheap, but entirely free from the limitations of the grid?
It is a profound shift in how we value geography and energy. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems around you. Keep looking for those symbiotic loops where one process's waste could be another's fuel, and we will see you next time. Because once you understand that a zero-waste industrial metropolis can thrive entirely off the grid, the traditional ways we build our cities suddenly feel very, very outdated.